Welcome back to Gems Popery. I'm Joe Heschmeyer, and I want to explore the idea of Eucharistic martyrs, people who died for the Eucharist in the early church. And I want to look at one of them in particular, St. Tarsicius, who's believed to have been a young boy, maybe 14 years old, who died for the Eucharist. Now, a few things to know kind of at the outset here. We know some about him from ancient sources, but there's other parts that we're less sure of. And Pope Benedict XVI, in preaching on him in 2010, acknowledged this fact. He says, we do not have much information about him. We're dealing with the early centuries of the church's history. More precisely, we're in the 3rd century. So this is the 200s. But the story that's come down to us, and I'll get into where we have a firmer footing and where we have a less firm footing, but the broad story is more or less as follows. There's a boy named Tarsicius. He regularly went to the catacombs of St. Calixtus. This is at the time when Christianity is illegal, and so the Christians are celebrating in Rome in the catacombs. So he's there. And he has a great love for the Eucharist and was probably an acolyte, meaning like an altar server, although even that is a little unclear. We do know this. Number one, this is during the period of the Emperor Valerian, who was harshly persecuting Christians. And number two, this is a period in time in which it was customary for the deacons to bring communion after Mass to those who were unable, you know, so prisoners and the sick, those who were unable to go to Mass themselves. And we don't know exactly why a deacon wasn't sent. There's a story, basically there were no deacons available, and so Tarsicius volunteers to go and is instructed by the priest and then sent on his way. But we at least know, you know, we know the time period, we know that this custom of taking the Eucharist to prisoners is dangerous at this point. One way or the other, Tarsicius ends up carrying the Eucharist, taking it to those who are sick. And along the way, he sees some of his pagan friends, and they want to know, what is it he's carrying? What's he being so secretive about? And he won't tell them. They then try to take the Eucharist away from him in the kind of bag that he's carrying it in, and they eventually seemingly realize he's a Christian and start to kick him and throw stones at him. As he is dying, a member of the Praetorian Guard, who is apparently secretly a Christian, brings him to the priest. But by the time he gets him there, he's already dead, still holding a small linen bag containing the Eucharist. And he's then buried in the same catacombs, the catacombs of St. Calixtus, in which he had gone to Mass, in which had been kind of the religious center of his life, right? And so this happens in the 200s. He apparently died in the year 257. In the next century, in the 300s, Pope Damasus has a special inscription written for him. Like, he writes a poem honoring him and comparing him to the deacon St. Stephen. Because remember, the role this boy is serving is traditionally a deacon's role. And so he compares him to St. Stephen, who was also martyred, also even stoned to death. And the part about Tarsicius says the following. So this is a very ancient inscription. This isn't like some later legend. This was next to his burial spot. And the inscription on it said, when the evil band was oppressing with its wickedness St. Tarsicius, as he was carrying the sacraments of Christ, he wished, when attacked, to give up his own life rather than to surrender the celestial body to the rabid dogs. The celestial body, of course, meaning the body of Christ. So it's a beautiful witness of someone who would rather die than see the Eucharist be desecrated or treated disrespectfully, taking very seriously Christ's admonition, do not give what is holy to the dogs. And as I've sort of intimated, this gives us a little bit of insight as well, not just for his own love of the Eucharist or the love of the Eucharist his fellow Christians apparently shared, that they would celebrate this, but also it gives us a little bit of liturgical insight into what this looked like. Now, I want to go back even earlier than Tarsicius. So remember, Tarsicius dies about 257. About 100 years before that, St. Justin Martyr is writing in what's called the First Apology, or First Defense. He's defending Christianity to the pagans, and so he's trying to explain a little bit about what Christianity is all about. And in the portion where he talks about what goes on Sunday in Christian worship, he says the following. He says, when the president, that is, the presider, has given thanks, and all the people have expressed their assent, those who are called by us deacons give to each of those present to partake of the bread and wine mixed with water over which the thanksgiving, Eucharistia, was pronounced. And to those who are absent, they carry away a portion. And then he explains the next line. Even though he's just described it like bread and wine over which Thanksgiving was pronounced, that probably doesn't make sense to a pagan. He says, "And this food is called among us Eucharistia, the Eucharist, of which no one is allowed to partake but the man who, number one, believes that the things which we teach are true, and number two, who has been washed with the washing that is for the remission of sins and under regeneration, and number three, who is so living as Christ has enjoined." So you have to believe what the Catholic Church teaches, you have to have been baptismally regenerated, and number three, you have to be in what we would now call a state of grace. You have to be living a Christian life. Because you could believe the right things, you could be baptized, and you could still be living a life of sin. But the three criteria that he lays out, it's very clear the early Christians in the 100s aren't practicing open communion. It's fascinating for all of those reasons, but I'm actually going to leave all of those things aside and just say, just look at that other part, the part he said right before that. That after the Mass, the deacons customarily were the ones who would bring the Eucharist to those who couldn't make it, which would be, of course, the sick, you know, the homebound, the physically disabled, the imprisoned, whatever the case may be. Those who were not able to join at the Sunday Mass, the Eucharist would be brought to them. And I want to actually contrast that with the way Eucharistic practice or practice around the Lord's Supper looks among many non-Catholic Christians, because there's a wide diversity on this. It isn't like there's a one standard norm. In fact, there are entire books, like O. Wesley Allen's book, Protestant Worship, that look at different approaches to worship within the world of Protestantism. But Allen makes a really fascinating point that among those who reject the idea the Lord's Supper involves a unique access to Christ's presence, and instead interpret the ritual as an expression of human action, or those who emphasize divine action in the sacrament but locate Christ's presence in the liturgical act of communing with God and with one another, that is, in short, those who believe the bread and cup remain simply bread and wine or bread and juice, feel no compunction about simply throwing the leftover bread in the trash and pouring leftover wine or juice down the kitchen sink. And look, on one hand, you can certainly empathize. If it's just bread, if it's just wine, nah, to hell with it. I mean, you can dump it down the sink, you can throw it in the trash. Fine, no problem. But of course, we should recognize that's in glaring discontinuity with what we see in early Christians like St. Justin Martyr or St. Tarsicius. But we can go even beyond that and say, there, you know, obviously not all Protestants fall in that category. There's some Protestants, historically Lutherans and Anglicans, who have a much higher view of the Eucharist or of the Lord's Supper. But even here, I would point to Roland Ziegler's article in the Concordia Theological Journal. He is a Lutheran professor and theologian who has an article called "Should Lutherans Reserve the Consecrated Elements for the Communion of the Sick?" In other words, should we do what St. Tarsicius did? I mean, he doesn't say that, but that's the basic question. Because should we be bringing the Eucharist from a liturgical celebration to those who were not able to attend? And he acknowledges at the outset that this is the universal custom in Roman Catholicism and in Eastern Orthodoxy. And, right, that's just straightforward. Like, you can look at 2,000 years of history. He says it's the universal custom for the priest to do that, but you can go all the way back to Justin Martyr and see it wasn't just the priest. It could also be the deacon or an acolyte, someone delegated by the priest to bring the Eucharist to the sick. Because why? It's already been consecrated. It isn't like a layperson is taking ordinary bread and turning it into the body and blood of Christ. No, the priest has already done that. And so what is now already the body and blood of Christ is then brought to the sick. But here's the thing. Traditionally in Lutheran theology, Christ is present in, with, and under the bread and wine during the liturgical celebration. And so this idea of bringing Jesus to the sick outside of the liturgical celebration doesn't actually work within a traditional Lutheran framework. And so he actually makes this observation. He says, from the perspective of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, this is a more like conservative Lutheran. You've got the ELCA, you've got the LCMS, and you've got the LCWS. So this is kind of the middle conservative, if that makes sense. So among conservative Lutherans, the Catholic and Orthodox practice would be regarded as an innovation to them. Obviously, it's not an innovation historically. It's 2,000 years old. But it doesn't make sense from a Lutheran perspective. You've got Lutherans who've started to do this, and he's pointing out this doesn't really work with our theology. And he points to C.F.W. Walther, the first head of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, a very influential Lutheran theologian, who gave detailed instructions about what the pastor should do. So the pastor, if somebody's sick, you go to their home and you basically just celebrate, you know, what we would call the Mass, right there at the bedside. But the idea that anyone other than the pastor, could commune the sick is just unheard of. Like, this is not something that he gives instructions for, and it's not like he overlooked this either, because Walther, remember, the 19th century kind of first important, he's the president of the LCMS, 19th century influential Lutheran theologian, he's quoting an 18th century Lutheran theologian who says that the holy elements consecrated by the pastor can neither be reserved nor sent to those absent, which he describes as a bad habit of some in the early church. So that's what I really wanted to kind of touch on, because it seems to me that the early Christians neatly disprove that, or at least stand in clear opposition to this. Because either St. Tarsicius is just an example of a bad habit from the early church, and Justin Martyr's First Apology, we'd have to say he's just describing bad habits. These are bad liturgical practices that never should have arisen. But remember, this is in the 100s and the 200s. The idea that these people don't understand Eucharistic theology or liturgy in the apostolic way, you know, think about it this way. We know that the apostles worshipped. We don't get a ton of details about the nature of their worship. We don't see, no one just lays out from start to finish, here's what everything looked like. No one does, in other words, what Justin Martyr does about Christian worship of his day in the first century. So then the question becomes, who's in a better position to tell us what first century worship is like? The Christians of the second and third century, or the Christians of the 18th and 19th century? And I would suggest that the earliest Christians, those closest to the time, are probably in a better position to tell us not just what the apostles said, but what they did and what they gave instructions to do on the ground. So when we look at early Christian models of worship, they don't appear to be just making stuff up off the fly. They appear to think that they're all supposed to do certain things in certain ways. Like, if you look about St. Justin Martyr, like, he's able to say, here's what Christian worship looks like across the church, across Christianity. He's not saying, here's what I do in my local church on Sunday. No, he treats this as something they've received. So I would suggest that there's good evidence that this isn't a bad habit. That the practice of bringing the Eucharist to the sick and homebound, of reserving the Eucharist even after Mass, is well established if you understand the Eucharist really is Jesus Christ, and he gives us his abiding presence. He doesn't leave us orphans, and that these actions make sense. So I'd leave you with that you can try to figure out, what do I think we should do? Or you can look at, well, how did the earliest Christians live and for what did they die? And I would suggest that they died for the fact that the Eucharist really is Jesus and continues to really be Jesus even after the celebration of the Mass has concluded. For Shameless Popery, I'm Joe Heschmeyer. God bless you.